I believe in my powers.
I believe in my powers.
I believe in the powers of my teammates.
I believe in the powers of my teammates.
I trust in my powers.
I trust in my powers.
I trust in the powers of my teammates.
I trust in the powers of my teammates.
Somebody get this big walking carpet out of my way.
Look, okay, just get any blunt objects together, all right? Get cornered, bash them in the head. That seems to work out.
I mean, what are we, a team? No. We're a chemical mixture that makes chaos.
Gentlemen, I'm Agent Carter. I supervise all operations for this division.
The needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few.
And
angels of love!
Welcome to the Skating Fanny Show. I am here with a very special guest, Michelle Encinosa Fu. Hello, sir.
Good morning.
I'm really glad that the person sitting next to me, or standing next to me, Dr. Libby Jinwei, mentioned that you were coming, because this is the first time I've ever interviewed someone from Cuba, which is pretty cool. So I wanted to start by asking you to say a little bit about yourself and about your trip to the United States, because as I recall, you mentioned it's your first time here.
Yeah, well, I'm a science fiction writer. And I also write about epic fantasy and some dirty realism, whatever they call it. And I was invited here to, give a small lecture on gender topics in Cuban science fiction, and also to participate in a couple of classes and talk about a bit about Cuba, about science fiction in Cuba, about my own work. And well, I'm having a great time here, actually.
Awesome. So folks that are listening, I mean, the fact that you're in the United States is largely because of some major political changes between the U.S. and Cuba. Our relationship is drastically changing, given that for years you could come here at all. How is that manifesting at home? Is that political change showing at home for you? I mean, you're noticing a change in the relationship between the countries?
Well, in Cuba, we are having all these expectations about what is going to happen with all these changes with the relationships between the Cuban and the U.S. And many people who years ago, they wouldn't watch the news about presidential campaigns here in the U.S. are now paying more attention to it since they feel that the results will influence the forthcoming changes in the relationship between our countries. And the funny thing is that they're waiting for these changes to happen, but they don't know exactly what are these changes going to be like. They don't exactly know what to expect, economically, socially, or politically. I mean, what is actually going to happen? Is the what things are going to get better, and what things exactly are going to get worse? So we're just waiting for things to develop further and to try to find out in which way we're going to turn.
Right. So, your talk that you gave yesterday was on sexism in Cuba, and one of the questions I wanted to ask was what you thought was one of the greatest challenges to addressing that problem of sexism in Cuban science fiction, or I guess writing in general in Cuba.
Okay, when it comes to sexism in Cuba, in fiction, probably the greatest challenge is for writers would be to understand what is actually sexism. Feminism, you know, all these terms, because since we are not, most of us, we are not actually sociologists, right? And in not just in Cuba, but also in the largest part of Latin America, there is a wrong concept about feminism, about what it means. Sometimes it is simply, they use it as simply opposed to machismo, you know, to male chauvinism. And for instance, most of the times when a woman calls herself feminist, it's like people feel like if she was calling herself female chauvinist, female chauvinist. So the terms in Latin America is a very difficult issue, actually. And in Cuba, particularly, you may ask a lot of women if they are feminist or not, and they would go, and they would say rather no, because since they don't really get what it means. And for most writers, well, in Cuba literature has been for the most part a thing of men. And every time Cuban writers try to use women as main characters, give them some leading role in the story, they do it a bit, let's say, they do it in a condescending way. They do it like, well, I'm gonna be nice with you, woman, girl, okay, whatever. I'm playing nice guy with you, and so you can think of me as a better man. But okay, that's it.
Ah, mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. That's definitely condescension. I think this is very interesting, because in your talk, you were describing, you know, how does sexism manifest in Cuba, and it was very familiar, right? And the ways mm-hmm. in which it was, you know, even in the United States, we've dealt with, and to some degree still are, mm-hmm. right? It's still like these very traditional roles, like woman in the house, she takes care of the house, you know, man does the work stuff. Those kinds of things. It's almost this oddly universal sort of sexism, which I don't know if that's something you've noticed as well, but it does seem to me like this keeps manifesting in all these places around the world. I don't know if you had any particular opinion on that.
Yeah, well, sexism is pretty much the same all over the world. And in our Western culture, it has almost the same characteristics in every country. Sometimes it depends on the economical level of a country. Sometimes it might depend to some degree on the cultural background or even a subcultural background in some areas of society. But it's pretty much the same. And for us, Latin American people, it's a very delicate topic when it comes to talking about equality, because most Latin American countries have these problems with what democracy is, and it's all everything is intertwined here. You see, like racial problems, sexism, and all sorts of discriminations, and the political systems. Whether they go truly democratic, whether they go after, I don't know, some dictatorship, a leader incarnated in a specific person. And for us Cubans, we have lived not just under a sexist social system for centuries, but a very discriminating one towards race, towards religion too. And we had this small joke back in Cuba. I won't tell the joke, but it was something about being at the same time a woman, black, Jewish, and communist. It's like putting a lot of discriminating things into a single person, you see. And well, that's pretty much what I can tell you about it.
Okay. Interesting. So I know, you know, in your talk that, and it's related to this subject, which is the problem of silence, right? Because you mentioned in your talk that in Cuba in particular, you know, certain issues were just sort of like that's not a thing. It doesn't exist anymore. And just by stating, like enunciating, it's gone, like you're no longer allowed to talk about it. And are you seeing that is significantly changing, that there's obviously a larger conversation about these issues, that we're now saying, no, we can't be silent about these issues?
Yes. Since the early 90s, I think, a lot of people began to bring these topics back on the table. Some years earlier, since, for instance, there was no racial discrimination, since there was, and I am doing this with
quotation marks, yeah.
With quotation marks, you could barely accuse someone of being discriminating you, since that wasn't supposed to be happening, and you would probably be the one being accused for framing someone. For discriminating you, I mean, since so it's that's what happens when you silence an issue like this, and with sexism it happened almost the same. But from the early 90s, there's a bit more freedom to talk about these things, to open the curtains on the subjects, and a lot of people are starting to publish books and theoretical studies, and we are having some events to discuss these topics and to try to subvert the way the government has the state of things that the government has built over the years. What we're trying to do is to try to make it for real, not just as an element of some political speech.
Okay, interesting. So on this subject, I know this is also something that came up, I think, at the end of your talk, which is that the book 1984 was only recently published in Cuba. From the perspective of a lot of Americans, right, we read 1984 in school, and it's sort of like this cautionary tale, right, like about totalitarianism and things like, you know, exactly what we're talking about, the ways in which a government can say this is not an issue anymore, right, because we say so and you're not allowed to talk about it. We change the language you're allowed to use. Do you think that the publication of this book in Cuba is rather significant, or do you think it's just sort of a, like, it's about time we got this book?
Well, I think it was about time we had this book published in Cuba, and I think that we could have done it a few years ago, actually, with the opening on many subjects and the crumbling down of some areas of censorship. But there are many other books that we still need to publish in Cuba for the ordinary reader, and a lot of many subjects that many people want to listen to, they want to hear about, they want to get informed on. And there are some writers, like Leonardo Padura, that they try to, what they do is they put in their novel work, they put a lot of research, and they try to uncover some areas of Cuban history involving world's histories, actually, that the Cuban audience is not used to being talked about. And I think it's great that we have 1984 published in Cuba. I remember that in the early years of the revolution, I think someone published Animal Farm.
Oh, okay.
But the book was picked up from the libraries. From the bookshops. In the early years, the publishing houses were still, some of them were still private, some of them weren't. They already belonged to the government, but the government still wasn't monitoring exactly what books were being published. So some books were actually published, and they were picked up from the bookstores and back to the industries, or turned into pulp.
Oh, wow, okay. That's interesting. That's such a 1984 kind of thing, too.
Yep.
So just kind of go to a different angle, to talk about yourself a little bit. You'd mentioned yesterday that you play RPGs. You know, you like to role play, and I'm really curious. What RPGs are you playing? I mean, I can guess possibly some, but I'm curious which ones you play and which ones you enjoy. And the side question that would be, in your own work, I mean, have RPGs influenced your work?
Okay, well, I used to play a lot of RPGs back in the 90s and the early 2000s. I played my group of friends, we played Traveler, we played Middle Earth, we played some Dungeons and Dragons, some Shadowrun, I think. I don't know, and currently I'm not these days playing any role-playing gaming specifically, since, well, you know, the old group of friends is a bit dispersed.
Okay.
Right? Mm-hmm. But I'm working on a couple of role-playing games of my own, and I'm wondering if I should, give them prepared in a book form, or rather get myself some programmer and some people that can turn into an RPG for some other platform for PC or I don't know or some console.
Okay.
But RPGs actually influenced many of us who are writing science fiction fantasy today in Cuba for many reasons. They brought us together to know each other, to form this small community of people that later on we would begin exchanging books and films and stuff and information, and then we would begin writing with each other by teaming up and creating our own role-playing games. And by creating our own role-playing games, we would be learning the rules of how to create a universe where to write some fiction in. And yeah, it was very influential.
Interesting. So just a quick question. So I mean, most of the games that you'd mentioned, things like D&D, Shadowrun, some games that we're very familiar with, are there Cuban role-playing games? I mean, are there people making their own role-playing games in Cuba?
Well, there were some people doing that years ago. Years ago, we played all these games, in the old-fashioned way, at a table with the pieces and the books of rules, the sheets of paper with your characters' forms, and the dice, of course. But then all of these PC games came in Cuba, and there were more PCs actually than before, and people began just playing over the net. Whenever they could, or they would try to build up their own small nets, inside the building where they live. And well, it's not just a new generation. It's many new generations have been around ever since, and we're the ones who still play RPGs the old-fashioned way. We're not as many as we used to be.
But his Ophidia, which is, started out as a role-playing game, became the location of his science fiction worlds, his science fiction cyberpunk trilogy.
Oh, okay.
Which he described to me as Cuba has become sort of a stop between the U.S., a big highway between the U.S. and Venezuela.
Oh, wow, that's one heck of a highway. Cool. Okay, so one of the other questions I did have, not RPG specific, but certainly related to your own writing, which is talking about your influences. I mean, I was reading your story, and it's Latin Cosmos.
Is that the exact title? Latinos.
The Cosmos Latinos. Uh-huh. And, I mean, obviously lots of cyberpunk influences. I could also see the RPG, because there's a guy who's called the Wizard in it, which, mm-hmm. And some RPG references, which mm-hmm. just made me giddy a little bit. I got a little excited. But I'm curious about some of your influences, like folks you read, wherever they may have come from, that, really got you interested in science fiction and fantasy.
Well, when you become a writer in Cuba, you come from a lot of different sorts of influences. You would have probably read the Latin American classics. You would have probably read the American classics and most of the Europeans, some of them classics like the French and some of the Italians and Spanish mainly, some of the Germans too. And as for influences, I could call in a few names when it comes to science fiction. Not just for cyberpunk. I could call on Gibson, of course, and Sterling, but I could also call on Scott Card, mm-hmm. and Le Guin, and Sima Bradley, and people like, you know, Paul Anderson, some of the old schoolers, right? And Herbert, of course, and and then Simons.
Okay.
Up to Hyperion. I hated Endymion. Anyway, and there are many authors who I love to read and keep on reading and to reread. I actually love some of the works of in space opera by, oh my god, the Vorkosigan saga.
Oh, McMaster Bujold.
By Bujold. I love it.
Okay.
I just love it.
My best friend is a huge Bujold fan, so you would get along. You guys could talk Vorkosigan forever. I'm curious, on the subject of Cuban writers, one of the writers that I read within the last year and basically recently discovered and kind of fell in love with was a fellow by the name of Reynaldo Arenas.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
And have you read him by any chance?
I have read some of his work, not all of it.
Mm-hmm. He's super depressing. He's very sad because his work is very dark. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it seemed interesting to me that, you know, we talked about 1984, and then you can read some of his work, like The Assault, is very dark and very... I mean, it's got these great scenes with people described as, like, giant caterpillar machines where they're all walking in unison to go to work. It's very interesting work. But okay, so cool, you've read it. Yay. Mm-hmm. I feel really excited about that. Out of curiosity, you've worked on... you've obviously written some fantasy. I know your main... one of your main works is a book called Sol Negro, which would be Black Sun. Are you currently... I mean, are there any, like, bites on possible translations into English?
Well, so far, maybe some or other short story that could get to be published, especially... over the net or something like that, but I'm trying to put my old books for a while in a drawer. What I'm trying to do is to create new books. I think I'm getting done for a while, at least with short stories. I'm trying to get some novels finished. I have finished some, but I didn't like them the way they turned out. What I'm trying to do is to finish some novels in order to try to get them to reach other markets outside Cuba, and that would probably mean some translation work.
Yeah.
So let's see what happens.
So you mentioned you're obviously writing some novels. Can you tell us about what you may be working on?
Well, I'm working currently in this saga with this girl whose name is Bianca, and just to go quickly over it, it begins when at her wedding day, her planet is under attack, and there goes the wedding, and she has to at the end of the book she has to become a soldier. She has to enlist to sign up in order to be able to leave the planet and survive, along with some of the youths of her family. So it's going to be like a group of youths, all family related. And they're going to become soldiers, and they're going to live the experiences of some other sort of type of war in space, in some in some colonies, and they're going to meet aliens, and they're going to undergo a lot, lots and lots of tragedies. And eventually, I'm gonna be slowly churning this series, this saga that will become in a very simple way. I'm gonna get it more complicated, and get it more political and more social and stuff like that.
That sounds like a lot of fun. Okay, so one last question, which is a language question, because I recall, you know, at your talk you'd mentioned, and someone had asked about, I can't remember exactly what they asked, but it came into the subject of, you know, the genderedness that's in Spanish. And the question I wanted to ask is not necessarily specific to that, but more about, you know, the difficulties in trying to navigate all of these new, and I say new in a very rough sense, right? These have been around for a while, but new types of identities. So people who, for example, identify as neither male nor female, transgender people, you know, different sexualities, like all of these complexities that are, if they're not new, they're certainly just more visible than they used to be. I mean, is that particularly difficult in Spanish to navigate?
Well, not so far, I think. I think Spanish is flexible enough. As long as the male root of it stays untouched, because that's how it keeps functioning. And I don't know. For instance, we don't do that you people do in English with let's see, for babies, that you call it until it gets to be like a year.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
So. For us, a baby is a she or a he since it's born, or well, since it's in the womb. So there is always a term, you know, an article, a way to define the sex of something, of any noun, anything. But so far we haven't have I think that sort of problem in Spanish, because we're still. Since we're remaining, we're keeping the male root of it.
Okay.
And so far that does it, you know. But I don't know if that is actually fair, but that's the way that the language works. And
yeah, so since you don't use, I mean, when you talk about the baby, right, you don't say it. I guess the question is what do you do with somebody who does not identify with any gender? I mean, how is that represented in Spanish? I'm curious. It's just because I don't know. It's not like that there isn't a word, but yeah.
Well, some people are trying to do little experiments with this, but they find it hard to actually picture it when writing it down or when saying it. What they do is they try to go a bit around the subject. They try to disguise their difficulty to express it by some trick, you know, on their syntax and on the way they write. And I believe that some way of doing it will eventually come by, but I just can't tell which one it will be. Perhaps it will come from outside, you know, from another language.
Okay, interesting. Yes, in the United States, we've had similar. I mean, we do have it,
yeah.
Right? We have it and they, which can be sort of neutral.
Yeah.
But we still have this problem because, like, you don't want to refer to somebody as an it,
right.
Like, you know, you're an it. It's sort of dehumanizing.
Exactly.
And so there have been attempts in science fiction in particular, and I know in early, I think, 1970s feminist critical theory, where they would come up with terms like je and gère and some other variations, right? It basically be the he-her format, but it would just be they'd add like a letter, or they'd change the letter to a Z or something. But, of course, it never quite catches on because it understandably sounds a little strange. And, you know, when you've said he and she for 30-something plus years, it becomes very difficult to suddenly add a new pronoun. Mm-hmm. So those things don't catch on. Yeah, so I don't know what the solution is in English, because I certainly don't want to run around calling people it.
Well, right. Yeah. I simply believe the solutions will come up by themselves. Mm-hmm. You know, whenever you try to artificially modify something in language, it doesn't work.
Yeah, that's fair. Okay, so last quick thing. This is an easy one. Do you have a website or any other way that people might find out more about you and your work?
Well, right now, I don't have anything personal. Okay. On the web, it's for some people in Cuba, that's a very difficult thing to do. Some people have the chance to do it themselves. Some people just pass on their materials, their stuff to somebody else who can do their websites. But I haven't been able yet to build it up something for myself or to maintain it.
Okay. But at least we know for folks that want to read in English, they can find one of your stories in Cosmos Latinos, which is really good. I read it this morning. It was wonderful. It was very strange, but mm-hmm. that's also wonderful because it's just like some of the things, like you'll just like throw out like a line, you'll just describe a type of person, right, like a group, and then that's it. Mm-hmm. And all I spend this whole time thinking of is like, what is that? What does that look like? Someone needs to make this into a movie and just have like some costume designer just designing all these people in the background. Don't mention them, just have like some guy walk by and like but anyway, sorry, that's me geeking out. So they can find you there. If folks want to find your work in English or Spanish, wherever it may be, where might they find some of your work?
Well, they would probably we just have to Google me and try to find out something out in the web, other than some websites.
Okay.
The thing is that I have some stuff, probably a few websites, but since I can't keep track of them, sometimes somebody comes up to me and tells me, "Hey, I found something about you on the web," and I say, "Oh, really? Tell me about it. I want to know about it."
Is anyone? Found something weird about you on the web? Something not true?
Well, I don't think so. So far, I don't think so.
Okay, you're lucky. You're very lucky. Well, thank you so much for talking to me about your work, talking about Cuban SF and everything. I appreciate it.
Well, thanks a lot to you.
Our intro and outro music comes from Nocturnia by Psychedelic Pedestrian. You can find out more about them on freemusicarchive.org, including the full version of the song. We obviously made some edits to the song, including sound effects and, of course, shortening the length. You can also support us by going to patreon.com/skiffyandfanty. If you'd like to send us a suggestion, you can do so at skiffyandfanty@gmail.com. You can also go to our website, skiffyandfanty.com, and check out the little suggested topic form at the top there. You can also just send us emails. You can also find us on Twitter at skiffyandfanty or on Facebook at The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Just search for us on there. Thanks for listening, and we hope to see you next time.